How is Pinstripes upgrading the bowling experience? Hello, this is Jonathan Mays, editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business, and in this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, I speak with Dale Schwartz, the CEO of the growing entertainment concept, Pinstripes. Dale joined us from the Restaurant Leadership Conference in April. We talk about, well, Pinstripes, a concept that combines bowling and bocce with a restaurant. It is part of a fast-growing entertainment sector led by such concepts as Topgolf. Dale talks about the chain's history and what makes his concept different than others, and particularly typical bowling alleys. He also explains its heavy reliance on events for much of the chain sales and how those events help the brand. We also talk about the need to have a great experience and great food, given the growing competition in the entertainment space these days. We also talk about the decision to go public via a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC. We're talking bowling and bocce on A Deeper Dive, so please check it out. All right, I am here with Dale Schwartz. Dale, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, tell us the story about Pinstripes.
Sure, it goes back 58 years. Bowled as a kid in Cleveland, always enjoyed it. Took dates bowling. After grad school, I spent 4 years, late 80s, with a private equity group in Manhattan, and was gonna buy a bowling alley on the Upper West Side, 74th and Broadway in 1989. We were gonna buy the bowling alley and do quality food, coined the name Pinstripes, pinstripe suit, upscale image, pun with bowling. Didn't do it, got busy, left New York, was in the biotech industry for a number of years, then I started an integrative pharmacy concept, and for 20 years, kept mentioning to friends and family this bowling idea. And then finally said, life's too short. And about 20 years ago, spent about almost 2 years putting the pieces together and started Pinstripes.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, before we get into, what was the best score you've ever had bowling?
That was about 19 years ago, 222. Right. I had about 5 beers when we were putting our team together for our first location. Yeah. And yeah, I got a little lucky. I wouldn't roll a 222 if I bowled today.
Yeah. But so you were in private equity, and you were looking at buying a bowling alley with the private equity firm?
No, just two friends on the side. No, private equity. I was one of three principals buying businesses. No, this was totally on the side, and then we all got busy. We didn't do it, and then I decided years later to just finally do it in a meaningful, full-time way, and that was the genesis of starting the concept.
Mm-hmm. So, what was your thinking? Why did you think that good food with a bowling alley would go together?
Well, when I grew up, like a lot of people, bowling once upon a time was just quality. So it was the community venue where you enjoyed yourself with family and friends. The industry didn't update its lanes, et cetera, for quite a long time. And the vision was to go back to the future. In the pharmacy business that I had started, we were kind of redefining the pharmacy business. So we had integrative pharmacies, picture Whole Foods with prescription products. And I wanted to do the same with bowling. And then we introduced bocce as well, all in the context of quality connections. And mind you, we opened May 2007, 2 months before the iPhone was introduced. So back then it was still just gather and spend quality time together. Bowling was just that sticky element that brought people together.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do to, what makes your food better than what you would see at a traditional bowling alley? And how did you get that taken
care of? Well, the exception to the rule is phenomenal food with entertainment.
Yeah.
And so from day one, we kind of pictured Hillstone, Houston's restaurant group, as True North. So our food is scratch kitchen, and it's hard to do, but we break the stereotype and have phenomenal food. Everything we do is the Italian-American duality of bocce bowling, Italian-American cuisine, Italian-American wines. So we have maple glazed salmon, and we cook our flatbreads and pizzas. We make our own pizza dough. We make our own marinara sauce. So really high quality food, because we want it to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Very different.
So I mean, it's, I think in today's environment, especially right now, where we have so many entertainment concepts emerging and growing, and then just period, you know, consumers have higher expectations.
Yep.
And in today's environment, you know, I don't think that you can really survive as a restaurant chain unless you're not going to survive very long unless you're really good, like really good at the food. You have to, the food has to be right. And I think that's been kind of a pretty significant shift in your sector, because like historically, like you're, you know, a lot of the companies that you've competed with, that you compete with, have not necessarily focused on the food. In fact, I remember Dave and Buster's in particular said, our focus is on the games. That is where the profitability is.
Oh, correct.
But they can't do that now. And what they're doing today is improving the quality of the food.
Correct. Food, generally speaking, for the other entertainment concepts in the past, the Dave and Buster's, the Boleros, the Topgolfs and others, food is more of an afterthought. So in our case, it's almost much different. So 75% of our sales is F&B. Not 70% gaming, bowling, bocce. No, the exact reverse. In fact, we host weddings every weekend, birthday parties, corporate events. So we'll host 1,000 events a year, each location, because of that elevated cuisine. Corporate events, social events want and deserve quality food. If we can host a wedding, we can certainly host a 20-person birthday party for six-year-olds.
Yeah, 1,000 events.
1,000 events a year per location.
Wow. Per location?
Per location.
So how did that, like, was that a deliberate thing or did that just happen naturally?
Very deliberate. That was modeled 18, 19 years ago after Maggiano's. So my first board member, Yorgo, was one of the early founders of Maggiano's. And Maggiano's back in the day was doing 14, 16 million top line at some of their successful locations, 5-6 million just in private events. Mm-hmm. So our venues are 25,000-35,000 square feet, large venues that lend itself to private events.
Right. So what is the percentage of sales?
Private events?
Yeah, from private events.
Almost half.
Really?
45-50% of our sales are private events, almost equally split social corporate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so does that mean like each of these locations have like somebody who specializes in selling these, or how do
Correct.
You get
so
that work?
Each location, we have anywhere from 3 to as many as 5 event sales team members that every day are selling corporate events and social events and are in the community. And then we do a robust Google AdWord campaign to drive lead generation. But yes, not remote selling, on site.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, but let's talk about the games, because still, like, the bowling obviously is very important.
Uh-huh.
Is it, who is the customer? Who, like, what, let me say this, like, outside the special events, of course, who is your typical customer of a Pinstripes?
Our customer is anyone that appreciates quality. Mm-hmm. So it's everything from a six-year-old to a four-year-old birthday party to 3 generations playing bocce together, grandparents, singles, couples. We're not 18 and over after 9 p.m. on a Friday night. So you come to Pinstripes, you may see a wedding going on and 6 other parties and a grandmother with their grandkids. It's just a community melting pot,
mm-hmm.
intentionally so.
Yeah. Now, do you do bowling leagues? Are there big Lebowski-style bowling leagues, or is it targeted at just regular?
Less so leagues.
Really?
We do so many events that it's a little difficult for us to put aside the lanes for leagues. And our locations, generally, we have anywhere from 12 to 16, 18 lanes. So we don't have 24, 36 lanes where we can afford to put aside 12, 16 lanes for leagues.
Mm-hmm. What was the, like, okay, so you added bocce ball later on. Why bocce ball? Like, why do that?
Bocce, I had seen bocce Bertucci's in Boston. I was at Harvard Business School. I used to enjoy it there. I was golfing in Scotland for nearly 20 years in a row. In Scotland, it's lawn bowling. And some good friends recommended, when I was putting the pieces together for Pinstripes with initially just bowling, to check out a bocce concept in Los Gatos, Campo de Bocce. I saw it and loved it. And so decided to marry bocce with bowling so that we wouldn't one-dimensionally just be a bowling martini bar like some of the other players at the time that were one-dimensionally just bowling concepts. Mm-hmm. So that's how we married the two.
Yeah. So, all right. So you spent most of your career doing things that did not have anything to do with restaurants.
Correct.
Or bowling, actually, for that matter, except, you know, periodically bowling yourself. Did anything about this business surprise you when you got into it?
Plenty of things. Yeah. It takes a while to learn any new business. Yeah. You know, we were fortunate with our first location in Chicago. We were busy. Certainly took a couple of years to choreograph the right labor model and the right balance between private events and bowling and bocce, what we call open play, when people just show up in the venue. So that took time. And just breaking the stereotype, generally speaking, when people hear bowling, they assume that the food is just going to be fair. And that is difficult to do. So you, like others, even if we say our food is elevated, they still stereotypically assume that, well, it's maybe finger food. So that takes time and not always easy to do.
No. Well, I mean, I think the consideration set in most bowling alleys is not to eat.
Correct.
It's just not, you're going there to bowl. And food is almost like a secondary consideration, you know, and then you just, in maybe you might get food.
Correct. Maybe. Whereas at Pinstripes, right, we have many of our guests that come just for lunch and they just eat. They may have bowled or had a party with us in the past, same with dinner. So we're a restaurant with entertainment, not a bowling alley with food. Mm-hmm. Big distinction.
Yeah. Now that said, you know, I mean, I live in Minneapolis and I'm pretty certain you're probably aware of it. Like we have a local bowling alley, Bryant Lake Bowl on Lake Street in Minneapolis. And most people don't actually even think of it as a bowling alley because the food is generally really good. So it's sort of.
And Minneapolis works. Had Bricks. It had a bocce concept on the roof.
Yeah.
Downtown Minneapolis as well, that we had checked out a number of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, all right. So how many locations are you at today?
So we're at 16 for another 4 days. We're opening Orlando Friday. I've been looking at that market for 16 years. So we're beyond excited. Orlando's a very sizable, exciting market. And yeah, our grand opening is this Friday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. So you're probably just going to head right over there, aren't you?
I'll head back to Chicago early tomorrow, and then I'll head to Orlando late Thursday to be with the team.
All right. So now how, like you with those kind of size locations, what kind of real estate are you targeting?
Size-wise, we target 20 to 30,000 square feet. Sweet spot now is about 25,000. We generally prefer two-level space. And in any case, we like very attractive space next to exciting co-tenants. San Mateo, we're next to Apple. We're next to and above Apple. Walnut Creek, that we're opening in a couple months. We're taking over the Crate and Barrel next to Apple. Hmm. So we like being in the mix in some of the high quality lifestyle centers or developments around the country.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that is like from your standpoint for your type, is it plentiful? Is the real estate plentiful? What kind of like, or is it a challenge finding these type of sites?
A little both. It's plentiful in that there's a tremendous amount of locations. So Macy's, JCPenney, Sears, all these big boxes that are closing present opportunities for us and others. The fun challenge is to be discriminate and make sure we just pick the right sites. So, you know, we're 16. We'll open 3 to 4 locations in the next 6-8 months. So we're always going to try to stay discriminate. We're doing Bellevue. We're doing Seattle. But at the right properties, there's still some very attractive real estate.
Yeah, yeah. Is it like, I mean, a lot of operators talk about like either second generation units or, I mean, your point, you know, like converting, you know, old retail, you know, closed retail sites. But like sometimes those locations are closed for a reason, right? Like there might be,
either traffic issues or for whatever reason the site just didn't work? Like, how do you know these days? So,
sometimes that's the case. Sears is an example. So some of these large 180,000 square foot Sears boxes, that's more a function of Sears' demise than where that particular Sears might sit. You know, we just opened an Aventura Mall in Florida. The Sears sat right between Nordstrom's and Bloomingdale's in a phenomenal location. Our San Mateo site was an old Sears. So the fact that some of these large boxes come back is not necessarily a check against them in terms of traffic or sight lines. It's more opportunistically the developers are taking back phenomenal real estate where maybe historically these large boxes were paying them below market rent and they can spend some capital and do their magic and add us and some others into the mix.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what are your plans? What is the plans for development over the next like 3 to 5 years?
We'll look to open 6 to 8 locations a year over the next 10, 15 years. White space for us is 150 locations all over the U.S. And then we'll have some fun overseas, more of a licensed franchise model in due time. But yeah, we'll continue to grow at a very controlled but exciting pace.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just completed a combination, did you not?
Correct. So we did, I'll use the accounting term, LIFO, last in, first out. We were the last company to go public December 29th and the first to list on January 2nd. So yeah, we went public via SPAC as the vehicle and we've been public for about 3 months now.
Now, why did you choose that route?
To raise some additional capital to set us up for the next 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. So myself and our team, we're about 2,000 team members now and we want to do this for quite a while. And the awareness, these types of podcasts and others that sometimes come from being a public company can help with sales, mm-hmm. can help with awareness and breaking the stereotype that we talked about a few minutes ago. So those are, and admittedly some of the recruiting benefits, now that we're a public company, that helps as well.
Yeah, right. So how did this SPAC process work? Was it, I've generally heard, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but somebody once told me that every CEO would rather go public via SPAC than a traditional IPO because it's easier.
Can be. That there's pros and cons of both.
Yeah.
In our case, our SPAC partner, Banyan, was operators. So Jerry Hyman joined our board, which is attractive. And the traditional IPO market was closed last year, mm-hmm. arguably is closed now.
It is still closed.
So yes. It's still closed. So that SPAC vehicle for us was an opportunity for us to make limoncello out of lemons and come out of COVID in an exciting way and access the market when we may not otherwise have been able to.
Yeah, yeah. The IPO market for restaurants is still mostly closed unless you are a certain type of concept.
Uh-huh.
And I've never quite understood why, but for some reason, the IPO window, I didn't necessarily bring you on here to rant about the IPO market, but I'm going to do it anyway, is just very narrow. And like, if you can only get in at a certain period, and if you can't, like then it is only open to very certain types of companies. I've been doing this for a long time. And there's just long stretches without any IPOs in the restaurant space.
No,
and the number
true.
Of publicly traded restaurant companies has shrunk. And basically, it means that companies like yours, you know, that have like growth, plenty of growth potential, have sort of a limited option of capital. Like that isn't necessarily available to you as an option.
Yeah, kind of. No, that's true. I mean, we had started some S1 IPO preparations 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Before COVID and even again during COVID. But to your point, the traditional market wasn't open. And so we opportunistically pivoted and that's how we effectuated our SPAC partnership.
All right. So probably the last question, what anything keeping you up at night right now? Anything that's concerning you in terms of just generally speaking with your business?
people. I mean, as we scale our business, the balance and challenge for us is we want to continue to add locations, but we don't want to be a chain. So we don't want to lose the special collection of locations we have and the special team members. So you need processes, you need SOPs, you need some of the structure that comes with scaling, but we don't want to lose that magic sauce. So yeah. it's a balance.
Right.
It's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a difficult one. Yeah. Dale, I really appreciate you joining me this week on the podcast. Absolutely. Oh,
likewise. Likewise. Thank you.
And that should do it for this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, which was edited, as always, by Spoons. Artwork by Nico Hines. You may find this and other episodes of the podcast on our website at www.restaurantbusinessonline.com/article/deeper-dive. And you may subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Jonathan Mays, your host, podcast producer, and the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business. Thank you for listening.